I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's July 5th, and we have a lot to talk about. Everybody remembers that day, that moment, when they were diagnosed with MS. You may not have known very much about living with MS, but in that moment, you probably felt like everything was about to change, and perhaps not in a very positive way. One of the most common emotional responses to MS is grief. And joining me to talk about the relationship between grief and MS, as well as share some specific steps and strategies that you can take to cope with grief, is Dr. Roslyn Kalb. Dr. Kalb is a clinical psychologist who's specialized in MS care and education for almost 40 years. She's a past vice president of the Professional Resource Center at the National MS Society, and currently, Dr. Kalb is a senior programs consultant at Can Do MS. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Roz Kalb, there are a few other things that you should know about. Over the past several months, the subject of myelin repair or remyelination has been in the news pretty consistently as announcements of new or ongoing myelin repair studies continue to be made. And when it comes to myelin repair, one of the questions that science will have to answer is why, even in a healthy brain, remyelination is not a very robust process. Two scientists in Germany have conducted experiments that might bring us a little closer to that answer. They focused on two proteins called tenascin C and tenascin R and found that in mouse models, these proteins block the regeneration of myelin by blocking the activity of myelin-producing cells called oligodendrocytes. In their experiments, the scientists used mice that had been genetically engineered so that they were unable to make either of the two tenascin proteins. They also used genetically normal mice that were able to produce these proteins. And to mimic chronic myelin loss, all the mice were given a chemical that causes myelin loss called cuprizone. And the results showed that the mice who were unable to produce the two tenascin proteins had developed more and thicker myelin sheaths. These mice, the ones who were not able to produce the two tenascin proteins, were also able to recruit more of those myelin-producing oligodendrocytes, as well as cells called oligodendrocyte precursor cells, or OPCs. As always, I want to remind you that there's a vast difference between a mouse brain and a human brain. But it's worth noting that this represents one more step toward understanding the process of myelin repair. And that makes it one more step closer to restoring function that's been lost to MS. Now, if you'd like to review the published details of this work, you'll find a link in today's show notes. A research team in the UK has published the results of what they're calling their country's largest study on fatigue and MS. And the study concludes that MS fatigue has an adverse effect on psychological and physical well-being. If you've ever experienced MS-related fatigue, or if you've ever observed someone who's experiencing MS fatigue, the results of this study should come as no surprise whatsoever. But evidence and data are what separate fact from opinion. And as I said, this is unsurprising but pretty conclusive evidence. The study involved analyzing data from 775 participants in the UK MS Register. The mean age of these participants was 54.7 years old, and the participants had been living with MS for an average of 13.2 years. 59.6% of the participants were living with relapsing remitting MS, 20.5% were living with secondary progressive MS, and 16.9% of the participants had been diagnosed with primary progressive MS. The MS subtype was unknown in about 3% of the participants. Now, interestingly, 507 of these 775 participants were not on any disease-modifying therapy. And that's really unfortunate, because there's abundant evidence that shows disease-modifying therapies delay MS progression, which means they help preserve a better quality of life longer. Well, the analysis showed that disease duration, greater disability, depression, and a diagnosis of secondary progressive MS were all significant predictors of MS fatigue. The analysis went on to show that fatigue severity had a significant impact on quality of life. And as I said a moment ago, I doubt this comes as any surprise, but better understanding MS fatigue eventually leads to better treatment for MS fatigue. And that's important. About 80% of the people living with MS experience fatigue, and fatigue is the most common reason for people with MS to leave the workforce. So figuring out fatigue and identifying treatments for fatigue means being able to keep working. It means someone can keep earning a living, they can experience improved psychological and physical well-being, and they can enjoy a better quality of life. And those are pretty compelling reasons. Now, if you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. While we're talking about the UK, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence has updated its guidelines for the diagnosis and management of adults with MS for the National Health Services in England and Wales. The new guidelines continue to recommend an annual review of all aspects of a patient's care, but the list of what that should cover has been expanded, and the guidelines, which are meant for patients as much as they're meant for healthcare providers, they recommend that patients should request this annual review if it isn't being offered. Enhancements to the guidelines include a more detailed focus on pregnancy and on advanced MS, recommending that healthcare professionals regularly ask their patients whether they're thinking of starting a family. And in cases where a patient's MS is advancing, healthcare professionals should provide information and support, covering topics including mental health, mobility aids, and even legal rights like employment rights and benefits, as well as the right to a caregiver assessment. The guidelines also recommend that people suspected of having MS but who don't meet the standard criteria for being diagnosed with MS should also be followed annually, and they should be provided with information about what to do and who to contact should they experience any changes in their symptoms. The guidelines provide an expanded list of pharmacological treatments for fatigue, including Provigil, modafinil, and amantadine. I'll also point out that more recent research has shown none of these treatments to be particularly effective in managing MS-related fatigue. The updated guidelines stress the importance of being treated by a multidisciplinary team, and hospital pharmacists and physical therapists have been added to the list of experts who should be a part of that team. And this detail shouldn't be overlooked. The updated guidance recommends that every person living with MS should be given a single point of contact to coordinate the care and services they require and to assist them in accessing that care. If you'd like to review the entire guidance document, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Last week, at the European Academy of Neurology's annual meeting, pharmaceutical company Novartis announced the results of an extension study that followed their Phase 3 clinical trial for Kesimpta. Now, in that Phase 3 clinical trial, participants received either Kesimpta or Aubagio, and the outcome of the trial showed that after 2.5 years, Kesimpta outperformed Aubagio in lowering relapse rates, preventing disability, and decreasing disease activity on MRI scans. So after the Phase 3 clinical trial for Kesimpta was completed, about 90% of the 1,800 study participants elected to continue in this extension study. And in this extension study, everyone received Kesimpta. The results of the study showed that almost 79% of the study participants who had been on Kesimpta for the entire duration of the clinical trial showed no evidence of disease activity after 4 years. That is, no relapses, no worsening disability, and no new inflammatory activity on MRI scans. After 4 years, comparing the extension study participants who had been given Kesimpta from the beginning of the Phase 3 clinical trial with those study participants who had originally received Aubagio, the group on Kesimpta was 4 times more likely to present no evidence of disease activity compared to the group who had originally received Aubagio. Now, this data was shared in an oral presentation at the European Academy of Neurology's annual meeting. So for those of you who may be looking for further details, this is a rare case where I don't have a published study to link to. One of the most common reactions to being diagnosed with MS is experiencing grief. And unfortunately, it's not likely going to be a one-time occurrence. Feelings of grief can also accompany MS relapses, new symptoms, worsening symptoms, increased disability, and disease progression. So if you're affected by MS, understanding grief and developing ways of processing those feelings in the healthiest way possible, well, that becomes an important coping skill. My guest, Dr. Rosalind Kalb, joins us in a moment to help you develop some new tools for your Living with MS toolbox as we explore grief and MS. Getting an MS diagnosis changes things. It can produce a flood of emotions, and one of the most common emotional responses to MS is grief. Joining me to talk about the relationship between grief and MS, as well as share some specific steps and strategies that you can use to cope with grief, is Dr. Rosalind Kalb. Dr. Kalb is a clinical psychologist and the senior programs consultant at CanDo MS. She's a past vice president of the Professional Resource Center at the National MS Society. She's authored a number of publications about multiple sclerosis, and Dr. Kalb has specialized in MS care and education for almost 40 years. Dr. Kalb has joined us before, and it's a pleasure to say welcome back to the podcast, Roz.
Thanks, John. I'm thrilled to be here talking about a subject that is really close to my heart and very important.
You know, grief is one of those things that I can imagine different people describing in different ways. So can you get us started with a definition of what grief is?
Sure. I think it is a person's very personal response to loss. And it's going to be experienced differently by every single person. But whether you lose a loved one, or a beloved pet, or you get a diagnosis of MS, which makes you have to rethink your self-image, the way you've thought of yourself for your lifetime up until that point, all of that can precipitate a sense of loss, of feeling bereft of something very important. People describe it as a hole in their heart. But everybody's description of it is a little bit different.
When I introduced our episode, I said that grief is a very common emotional response to MS. What are the things that people with MS are grieving?
Well, as I said, I think it can start with those words, you have multiple sclerosis. So getting a diagnosis of MS makes somebody have to sit back and say, well, wait a second. How does that fit into my sense of who I am? I have this picture that I've put together over my life so far of what makes me unique, my talents, my quirks, my foibles, my charms. And now I have a chronic illness, and it's an unpredictable chronic illness. So how do I deal with that? How do I find a place for that in my self-image? So letting go of the old picture and tweaking it a little bit to fit in this new information about a chronic illness is the very first thing. And people do grieve that. But then MS calls on people to grieve over and over again because it might make it impossible for a person to do their work or a beloved hobby, or may make it harder to just get out and be in the world. And so every time it takes away something, there is a grief process that goes on.
So on the one hand, we have this emotional response, grief to maybe a diagnosis or maybe a flare or a new symptom developing or along something along those lines. And on the other hand, we also know that one in every two people living with MS is at some point diagnosed with depression. So how does someone tell the difference between what they're feeling? Is it grief or is it depression?
It's a really important question, John. So I'm glad you asked it. It may be difficult to distinguish the two, particularly if the grieving process goes on for an extended period of time. But I think there are some important distinctions. Grief ebbs and flows. When we lose a loved one or we lose something precious to us, there is a peak of emotional pain. But nature allows us to gradually heal over time. We don't stay at that peak of sadness. We heal. In depression, there is no natural self-healing. Depression needs to be treated and resolved in order to go away. So how would you tell the difference? When people are grieving, even at their most intense points of sadness and loss, they may still be able to enjoy some things that they always enjoyed: time with a really close friend, watching a beloved old movie, working on a hobby that they find soothing and creative. There's still moments of pleasure or joy in the midst of the sadness. Depression isn't really like that. When people are depressed, not only are they sad or down or blue most of every day for days and weeks at a time, but they also lose interest in the world around them. They don't care about participating in activities. They don't care what's going on. They don't feel connections to others around them. They are really closed into themselves. When you're not sure what's what, or if your grieving seems to have gotten a little more complicated or gone on longer than you think it should, that's when a mental health professional can really help you tease out. It takes a professional to do that. You may not be able to figure it out for yourself.
When some people hear the term grief, they might think of the five stages of grief that were outlined by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. She described these five stages of grief as it relates to mourning someone's death. And the stages she identified are denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and then finally acceptance. I'm wondering, do these five stages of grief hold true for someone who's diagnosed with MS? And if they do hold true, does everyone living with MS go through all five stages, and do they go through them all in the same order?
It's my personal take on this subject that I've developed over the years and years of my life, that it's a lot more complicated than that and a lot more individual than that. I think that all of those feelings can happen. Not everybody will experience all of them, and certainly not everybody will experience them in the same order. And because MS, unlike death, keeps making new demands on you, takes more things away, it's much more of an ebb and flow that happens over the course of the illness. There'll be peaks of grieving that could be sadness. It could be anger. It could be saying, okay, you can take my legs, just let me keep my thinking skills. Or I need my eyes for my job. You can take anything else you want. That sort of bargaining. But I think it's so individual, and not only from one person to another, but from one episode of grieving to another. Something might make you intensely sad, but the next thing might just really make you angry. It varies.
I think it's reassuring to know that grief is a common and natural reaction to an MS diagnosis or an MS flare or perhaps a new symptom. But can you explain the difference between normal or I guess what we can call healthy grief and prolonged, pervasive, or complicated grieving?
You know, it's an interesting question, and they've just in the last several weeks added a form of complex or extended grieving to the psychiatric criteria. And there was a lot of controversy about this. The psychiatrists who work on the manual of mental disorders wanted that complex extended grieving added so that people would be able to get insurance coverage for any treatment that they might need, which is a good motivation for doing this. On the other side of the argument, however, is a very strong feeling that grieving is normal and healthy and should therefore not be given a psychiatric diagnosis. I think there's reasons on both sides why this is a valid argument and a good argument, but I think what the psychiatrists were referring to here was a grief that happens for some people who are not depressed. They do not meet the criteria for depression, which is that loss of interest in things or that sadness all day, every day, but it goes on and on forever. So it might prevent them from connecting with a new partner, for example, if they've lost somebody, or it might prevent them from, in MS, for example, being willing to make some adaptations. I'm too busy grieving over what I can't do to begin to explore ways I could do things that would keep my life busy and interesting and exciting. So I think it's a kind of grief that freezes one in place would be my best description of what that complicated grieving is like. Doesn't require medication to treat it, but it might very well benefit from some counseling around those issues or being in a supportive group with other people with MS to share those feelings and think about just taking the tiny steps out into the world to try things in a different way than you've done them before.
You mentioned a couple of times now the idea of seeking professional help to cope with grief when it's necessary, mm-hmm. when it feels like that's going to be something that could be helpful to you. Who should people be talking to when they're ready to talk to someone?
So I have my bias here, but I think that mental health professionals can be extremely helpful. And there are a variety that you might consult depending on who's available in your community. Although I have to say one of the few benefits of COVID is that there's a lot more mental health service available virtually than there ever was before. So I think you can reach out to an MS navigator at the National MS Society and say, I would like to talk to someone with expertise in MS who is a mental health professional in my community. That might be a psychologist like myself, or a social worker, or a licensed marriage and family counselor, or even a psychiatrist if the question is whether medication might be beneficial. So there are a wide range of professionals with expertise. I just think it's helpful to look for somebody who either has some familiarity with MS or maybe a health psychologist is another kind of discipline, a new specialty since I came into the field where they actually focus on people living with different kinds of chronic illnesses or health conditions that have emotional aspects to them.
So talking to a professional is certainly one road to take. Can you share some other strategies for coping with grief?
Both at the National MS Society, where I used to work, and at Can Do Multiple Sclerosis, where I work now, we have found that people connecting with one another, either in support groups or in small group workshops or problem-solving sessions, coaching sessions, we call them, people learn from each other, facilitated by a professional, a mental health professional, but they are sharing their challenges and their feelings and learning from other people with MS who get it, what they have done to cope and adapt and begin to figure out how they're going to live their lives with MS, whatever changes may come along. So I think the professionals are one part of the puzzle, but I think getting support and ideas, creative ideas from other people living with similar challenges is the most interesting, exciting, and really empowering way to deal with the grief and loss from MS.
We often hear that people living with MS tend to be or learn to be resilient. Can you talk about resilience and positive psychology and how they can help people address grief and other challenges of living with MS?
Resilience is a pretty hot topic these days, and people are often confused, I think, about what that means and whether they have it or not. But resilience really means the ability to bounce back from a challenge or a hurdle, feeling better able to take on the next challenge. I think we're all born with some degree of resilience, but like every other aspect of human life, some of us have more of it naturally and some of us have less, but it is a skill that can be nurtured and improved. So when you hit an obstacle or a problem or something that frightens you, and you take steps to manage it, you feel a sense of accomplishment. You feel a sense of strength that comes from finding the tools and resources and overcoming that challenge. In addition to that, it leaves you feeling better prepared, more confident about taking on the next challenge that might come your way. So each time you do that, each time you go through that process of challenge and solution, you feel stronger. And when you go to those support groups or coaching sessions that I talk about, or you participate in small group workshops to think about how to manage symptoms that you have, the sharing of your challenges and the tools and tips that work for you with other people, that also helps you build your resilience. You are teaching what you've learned even while you are learning from others. So it's a shared resilience muscle building, if I can say it that way, okay? And I think it happens all the time. Positive psychology contributes to all of this in a variety of ways. I think when I think of positive psychology, one of the big things that comes to my mind is the way we talk to ourselves, right? Everybody needs a cheerleader, but you can be your own cheerleader. If you think about all of your inner brain chatter that goes on, most of it is negative. We're pretty hard on ourselves. We criticize ourselves. We think we're not measuring up or we're not doing enough. If for every negative message you say to yourself, you practice saying a positive message, you can gradually tip that balance a little bit so that your brain chatter to yourself is as reassuring, comforting, and loving as you would be with another person. You want to treat yourself as well as you would try to treat the other person. So that's one aspect. Practicing gratitude, thinking about the things that you're grateful for, happy about, that are going well as focusing on challenges is really helpful. So every night before you go to sleep, just reminding yourself about the things that you're grateful for that happened that day or that are going on in your life.
Well, Dr. Rosalind Kalb, thank you for all that you've done and continue to do to improve the quality of life for so many people affected by MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you for inviting me. I always enjoy it, John.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/253. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.